I'm very happy now to welcome back to the program Victor DeSouvreau. He is a poet, and his ninth book of poems has just come out. It's called Considering. He's former director of the National Poetry Association. He was one of the people who established National Poetry Week in San Francisco, which has now become National Poetry Month, and it's been celebrated all across the United States. He's one of the founders of Penn New Mexico, the New Mexico Book Association, and the Poetry Center of New Mexico. And he will be at Collected Works Bookstore on Monday, the 10th of September at 6 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
It's wonderful to be here. Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, you've been writing poetry, what, all your adult life?
Well, I started writing when I went to sea when I was 16 years old.
You went to sea when you were 16 years old?
Yes, as a merchant seaman, because I was too young to be accepted in any of the armed forces. And besides that, we were political refugees, and I was an enemy alien. And so the only branch of the services that would accept me was the merchant marine, because they accepted anybody. The carpenter on my first ship only had one leg, for example.
Wow.
And so we went off to sea, and I sailed the Pacific on merchant ships from Guadalcanal all the way up to Leyte and Lingayen Gulf.
Where was your family from that you were a political refugee from?
My father was in the Italian diplomatic service in China, but he, being Jewish, when the orders came to ship us back to Italy, with the help of the Jesuits and with the help of the U.S. consulate, we were able to get a visa and get on the President Cleveland, which brought us into San Francisco on February 24th, 1941.
And so you were able to be here, and you were able to be refugees, but still you were on a list that prohibited you from serving the country.
Well, because I was too young. I wanted to do something about the war, and if you were 16, they didn't accept you in the Army or the Navy. And being an enemy alien on top of that made it a little difficult.
Now, when you went to sea with the Merchant Marine, did you start composing poetry at that tender age of 16?
Oh, yes, because I'd been brought up with poetry. My father and mother had me reading and memorizing the Divine Comedy when I was 10.
In Italian.
So, and we have a group here in Santa Fe that meets every Thursday that discusses the Divine Comedy, and we're still doing that after 14 years.
Do you remember any lines of it in Italian that you could recite for us?
Well, the beginning. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Ai, quanta dir qual era cosa dura in esta selva selvaggia ed aspra e dura che nel pensiero rinnova la paura. And that's the beginning of the Divine Comedy that says I've lost my way in the middle of my life and I don't know where to go in this dark wood. Where I have lost all my hope and all my desire for the future. And that's the loss of his of the right way, which was the beginning. And then he meets Virgil, and Virgil takes him on through hell and through purgatory until he gets to the foot. After mounting the mountain of purgatory, he gets to the foot of the climb into heaven, and then Beatrice comes and helps him on his way.
Something I've wondered about the Divine Comedy is, do you feel that Dante, when he was writing it, felt that he was divinely inspired, or is it more like a kind of intellectual exploration?
I think it was a bit of both. I think that, first of all, in the Divine Comedy, one of the things that I always found difficult is the fact that Dante was, in fact, married and had children, and he never mentions Gemma or his children at all in the Divine Comedy. Everything is dedicated to Beatrice and the heavenly love that she inspired in him.
whom he saw once when she was 9 years old for 5 minutes or something like that.
Exactly. No, she was 11, I think. But he only saw her twice, but that was the excuse that he used in order to write it. And he finished it all right, but when he died, he actually had been exiled from Florence, and he wrote it in, he finished it while he was exiled, and it was his way of showing the world that he was a great poet and that he would do something that no one else had ever done, which is to explain. And he formulated some of the beliefs that up to that point in the history of the Catholic Church had not really been formulated. So he not only wrote it, but he invented a lot of the things that are now taken for granted and have been ever since he wrote it.
Do you remember what some of those things are?
Yes, the fact of that hell consisted of the different levels, because no one had really discussed what hell was like. So he invented the whole business that there certain sins were more devious, more grievous than others. And so as he went down through the various layers of hell until he finally got to the bottom. And hell, the ultimate hell, is not a fire, but it was ice. And so he went all the way down up to the ice in which the devil Cerberus himself was frozen for all time. And then he and Virgil climbed back up to the mountain of Purgatory. And but there are all kinds of stories that he was able to weave in and out of. The story of Ulysses, for example, which he restated in ways that became popular. And the Divine Comedy was something that he finished while he was in exile in Ravenna, where the Lord of Ravenna had helped his last years and kept him there. And when he died, everyone that was connected with him thought he had not finished the Divine Comedy. But then his children found the last four cantos in a hole in the wall where he had put them. And
oh my goodness.
These are some of the details that people forget about it. But it was necessary, we felt, it was felt at the time in growing up in an Italian household to memorize the Divine Comedy. And when I was 10 and 11, my mother would trot me out when she had a ladies' tea and say, "Will you do Canto 5? And so I would have to recite the story of the two lovers who were condemned to hell. But the whole business of the Divine Comedy is one that really caught the interests of people over the centuries, and it's always been. I mean, there are some 14 translations of the Divine Comedy into English, and you wouldn't have that many translations if there weren't a continuing interest. And every translator thinks that he's going to do a better job than the others,
right?
So they keep doing it, but. From there, when I went off to sea as a merchant seaman, I started writing poetry because the other people, it was not possible really to discuss poetry or any of the intellectual things that I've been brought up to. And so it was a defense in a sense. And so that's when I started writing. But I've kept up the writing for all this time, and when I went to Berkeley, I was at the editor of the Occident, which was the literary magazine of the University of California, and so I did that. It's writing poetry is something that I feel is necessary.
Would you like to read a poem from your new book?
Yes. I always appreciate an opportunity to do so. And they say we use empty words. They say your words are empty. They do not hold a thing. It's only living flesh that counts, the unique person standing there in front of you. And yet, all of us are interchangeable. Queen Isabella's skull and Montezuma's look mightily the same today, and all the world's magnificence fades into gray as we go on. It is not bone and muscle that remain, not tongue, not brain, but words alone that sing and come back again with tears and joy and pride and tenderness to shine and shape our days. We're blessed with voices. Let us then praise it all, even the pain, the bad choices, and the falling rain, praising fish and birds and children out at play, knowing that our empty words are still the only keepers of our dreams and histories.
Victor de Souvereau, I was thinking about the word praise in that poem. What does it mean to praise fish and trees and all these beings that really don't care whether we're praising them or not?
Well, praise is a question of recognition. And when you praise the old religious idea of praise the Lord, and the whole idea of praise is to celebrate, is to acknowledge, and to praise is to acknowledge and to present, because the word praise itself comes from the same root as presentation. So you praise the Lord and pass the ammunition, or praise the Lord for any situation that you want. But to praise the birds, to praise the trees, to praise even the living flesh, is to acknowledge its existence, or the existence of those birds, of those streams, of those trees, so that you can acknowledge how wonderful they are in the overall fabric of our lives. And the idea that we should praise things that are inanimate, we have gone through so many levels of belief. You know, there was a time when we as humans would build cathedrals because we believed all of the things that would come as a result of our being devout and building cathedrals. Now we build casinos instead of cathedrals. Why? Because we believe that we're going to get rich in the casino and glorify our present instead of glorifying our future, as we did when we were building cathedrals. Nowadays, there's more money that goes into casinos than goes into the various churches.
Is that right?
It is absolutely amazing. If you consider how much money is spent in the casinos in the United States of America alone, without going to Macau or anywhere else, you're seeing more money than most probably the gross national product of the five countries right after the United States. It's absolutely incredible. But it's all because of the belief system, which went sideways. I mean, we used to believe in heaven, and if you did all of the good things, that you'd get to heaven. Now, you believe that if you go to the casino and pick all the right numbers, that you'll have enough to have a good life in this in this time that you are on Earth.
I have to say, though, the cynical part of me says, I mean, they were buying indulgences way back when they were building those cathedrals, and there was nepotism and corruption of the most blatant sort.
Of course, and the situation with all of the money that went to the popes, and all the money that was paid into the various papal treasuries, because the popes also had territories, not only the churches, but the papal states were in Italy and were in existence until 1810, I believe. The papal states were still run by the Pope. And so you always had the church involved in the sale of indulgences, as you said, and a whole variety of things. But you paid for things then, and you're paying for things now in a different way, because there are a lot of people who go and take their Social Security checks to the casino and who don't put their money into the basilica's building fund. These are all the stories. But I mean, even the wonderful story about the Basilica of St. Francis here in Santa Fe, when Bishop Lamy came. The old church that was the mother church for Santa Fe was an adobe structure that was falling apart. So he wanted to build a new basilica, which is basically what we have today. And there wasn't enough money in the bishop's treasury to build a church. So he got a loan from the Jewish merchants who were here. And he wasn't able to pay the loan back on the terms that had originally been agreed upon because there weren't enough Catholics to put enough money in the till. So he hadn't made the payments on time. And Silverstein, who was one of the merchants, asked Bishop Lamy to come to his house for Christmas dinner and make sure that you bring the mortgage, he said. And Bishop Lamy, with shaking hands, did show up from Bishop's Lodge and did show up with the mortgage. And after dinner, when dinner was over, Silverstein asked Bishop Lamy, "Did you bring the mortgage?" And he said, "Yes, you asked me to bring it." And with a shaking hand, Lamy handed it over to Silverstein. And Silverstein took the mortgage and stuck it in the candle. And the fire from the candle burnt up the mortgage. And he said, "And that's your Christmas present." And Bishop Lamy said, "Thank you so much."
Wow.
And so that's the story. And that's why the Jewish Torah symbol is over the entrance to the cathedral that we have today.
Very interesting.
These are some of the things that you pick up as you go along. It's just fascinating.
We're talking to poet Victor DeSouvreau. So how did you find yourself in New Mexico, in Santa Fe? You put out this whole book in your press, Penny Whistle Press, in which you asked so many people this question, the book We Came to Santa Fe. How did you end up here?
It was very simple. In 1969, I wanted to... That was when Amtrak was going to take over all of the railroad systems. And my children are very young, but I wanted them to have at least one night in a sleeper train. And so before they shut down all the sleeper services, which Amtrak was going to do. And now that they're thinking about privatizing Amtrak, it's very funny to see how it goes around. But I asked Henrietta, mother of my children, to whom I was married at the time, to find a place where we could go and have an overnight in a sleeper. And when I came home that night, when we were living in Sausalito, she said, I found an overnight we can take from Berkeley and go down to Bakersfield and we'll overnight. And I said, "Where are we going?" And she said, "I don't know. It's a place called Lamy." And so we went to Lamy, and there was a car waiting for us, and I didn't know anything about Santa Fe, but we came up, and it was the weekend when the Tierra Maria shootings were going on. And so we ended up at the Bishop's Lodge, and that's where I started to find out about what Santa Fe was about. And so I knew about Frank Waters, and I knew about some of the people that were involved, so that when my life changed, and Barbara, who's my wife now, was from Southern California, and she had too many ghosts in her past for me to go down to Southern California when I got divorced, and I had too many ghosts of mine in Northern California. So we decided to go to a neutral place and make our own ghosts happen, and so that's how we came back to Santa Fe, and we've been here for 26 years now.
Do any of those ghosts appear in your poems, or have they vanished?
No, some of them are still very much, very much here. But you asked me to bring a couple of poems, and there's one, speaking of ghosts, people forget what Memorial Day was all about. And I'd like to read a poem about Memorial Day that I wrote for this year's Memorial Day 2012.
Excellent.
good. This Memorial Day that honors and remembers all who died in service of their country began as a recognition of those killed in that first fratricidal war of ours, the so-called Civil War, and then continued on over the years to include a recognition of all those killed in all those other wars of ours, so that we could continue to define ourselves as the one species on this planet to repeatedly engage in the killing of our own kind. No lions, tigers, eagles, sharks, or alligators have ever joined with others of their own to kill any others that were like them. No, we humans have specialized in creating beliefs and flags and banners to justify this sort of behavior and to raise our children to believe that it is good and proper to grow up and give them all, even their lives, for causes that will bring them to the point of killing or enslaving others who are like, think like, love like all the other humans in this world of ours. We're the only ones that kill our own kind. You don't see deer bunching up in herds to go kill other deer. You don't see eagles in the sky flying to kill other eagles. And
I think there are some, actually, if we're going to go into science, which we probably shouldn't do, but ants kill each other, for example.
Who?
Ants.
Ants. Ants do. And they're the only critters that do. Name me another one.
Well, this is probably for another show and for some wildlife biologists.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of territorial, even chimps, there are animals that do kill each other, but the point is well taken and the Memorial Day poem is well taken because we've made it into what you're getting at is that we've made this killing of each other into an institution of our species rather than an occasional territorial phenomenon.
Yeah, true, and very well put. But it is, it's been territorial from the days of Rome and before, and, from the times of the Greeks all the way to present-day Libya and the things that are going on in Afghanistan, which is just absolutely disgusting. We should be able to do better than that with everything we've come to know.
When you write political poems, poems of this nature, poems about violence and war, what is going on inside of you? Are you trying to express the frustration of it? Are you trying to do your part to stop it?
I hope that my poems will inspire people to think more about what they do, what they are doing, and what they're responsible for. And one of the main things is to honor the human condition, because it's very, very necessary to know. I've got a poem here called An Empire's End, which I would very much like to read, which I think answers your question. After Constantine, could anyone have foreseen how quickly the Roman Empire would crumble and fall into the pieces that we still can see and admire today? And before Napoleon had mustered his 400,000 grenadiers and all the other soldiers in his forceful armies to head into the Russian winter that stopped him cold, did anyone at all foresee that rout and absolute disaster of Waterloo that left only memories behind? With all we know of the capriciousness of history, would anyone at all have dreamt that perhaps the disaster of 9/11 had been orchestrated and started the plunge of our own nation into a war whose outcome is certain to reverberate into the centuries to come as the beginning of another end? We, alive and still relatively well, see markets fall and torture and genocide accepted as required. In this, we're all complicit, and even with the best of intentions, cannot change the pull of gravity or the inevitability of our own empire's end. It does seem possible that unless we change our ways and change ourselves, our stories, and all we've ever known could come to be nothing more than a small disturbance in the galactic scheme of stars and planets in this universe we call our own.
Victor de Souvereau, what do you mean by change our stories?
We now have stories that celebrate the triumph of one flag over another. What we're going to do in Afghanistan in terms of the Taliban and all of the rest of it, that's a belief system. If we were to pull back and be ourselves, and I'm not proposing a Ron Paul kind of disengagement, I'm proposing the fact that if we recognize that we as humans only have a certain sphere of influence, and for us to, we have over 900 military bases and establishments around the world. We now are the kind of global power that the Roman Empire thought it was in its own day. And we, with drone strikes, are able to take out and kill people who are technically guilty as well as innocent in Yemen, in other parts of the world. And when I say it's our empire, the possible of being an empire's end, the Constantine, when he was the emperor, there was no question about his having power over the whole world that he ruled. So whether it's Obama or whether it's anyone else in terms of our life in America today, we believe that we can control anything anywhere in the world. And if we don't control it, we're going to send in drones and we're going to set up our own field structures in order to take them out. And that's been true in Yemen. It's been true. I have a friend who's a translator who just flew into Djibouti on the Red Sea, which is the little small French possession next to Eritrea and Somalia. And she flies as an interpreter. And that's a perfect example of the internationalization of our world, because now we're everywhere. And it's pointless to say that America is only America. We are involved in all of the rest of the world. We're involved in Colombia. We've got all. We have all of the marijuana people who have been convicted that represent over 60% of our prison population for marijuana and other things like that. And my hope is that that it will be possible for us to postpone the end of our so-called empire, the end of America, for long enough for the children to grow up and take some responsibility for what's happening. Because right now, we're at the edge of a cliff, in spite of everybody having used that analogy. But it's not only a fiscal cliff, it's a cliff of belief. It's a cliff of not only belief in terms of the humanity of people, it's a question of the cliff that exists in terms of our belief systems, in terms of our ability. Just as the Romans believed that with Constantine it would last forever, but it didn't. And let's acknowledge our own humanity. Let us acknowledge how we need to be with each other, which is kinder, which is more responsible, which is gentler, rather than just knock and kill.
We're talking to Victor de Souvereau. In some of the early poems in your new book, you talk about how poetry has become poetry slams and become competitions and things like that, and there's a kind of longing for poetry to be delightful and songs, again, of praise and beauty and not just competition and slamming.
Yes.
Although you're slamming war.
I am slamming. I am slamming war. But the point is that I'm slamming things that hurt rather than things that don't. Liberty, freedom, ability to choose, anything at all within reason, of course, without invading another's turf, rights, or ability to live freely themselves, all vibrant, desirable, and worthy as goals, so that we all may, without strictures, boundaries, impediments, or even rules, do what we want, when we want, in any way we want. Freedom, which comes with money these days, with the ability to pay in one way or another. This goal, made manifest in the statue with its torch, the Statue of Liberty lighting the way to freedom, it is said. And yet, might there be another great lady, not as well publicized, but powerful, fueling all of us to reach the place where liberty can reign? Is not her name Hope? The powerhouse, the engine that makes it possible for us to reach and to experience liberty, among other things. Hope, the mother with her child, for the present as well as the future. Hope, the real engine that keeps us going, even when the entire world seems to deny the future, let alone tomorrow's bills.
Victor DeSouvreau, now, you've been writing poetry all your life. You have many books of poetry. You've been active in so many, National Poetry Association and National Poetry Month and Penn New Mexico and the Poetry Center of New Mexico. And when you look back, what is your proudest achievement, and is there anything for which you would like to be particularly remembered?
My feeling is that the latest book is always the one that is just like the youngest child. But I have been asked so many things, and I have to answer with the name of this latest book. Considering the fact that I'm 85 and still alive, considering the fact that the world is in the condition that it is, I'm very happy to have been here with you, and I thank you very much for the opportunity to have you help me get a crowd to come to the Collected Works bookstore on Monday, September 10th.
Monday, September 10th at 6 p.m., Victor DeSouvreau will be reading from his new book, Considering. It's a book of new and selected poems. He is the founder of Penny Whistle Press and so many other wonderful, wonderful institutions. And his website is victordesouvreau.com, which we will link to on my website. Thank you so much for being here.
Delighted.